Welcome to Life After Business, the podcast that helps you understand how to increase the value of your business, what your company is worth, and what your exit options are. Host Ryan Tansom and his guests give you all the information you need to get clarity and control over your business and take pride in a valuable company that gives you freedom and choices to exit on your terms.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. This is episode 195, and I'm excited for today's episode because there's a lot of stuff going on right now, and this is a super uplifting interview that I just got the warm and fuzzies from because we're going to be talking about people culture and what that means to your company and how to be balancing your culture and your employees with the financial situation that you might be dealing with. Because a huge challenge right now that I see business owners encountering is the decisions that need to be made about how to balance the interests of one's operations, the culture that you've built, and keeping that culture intact, keeping employees on board, making sure that you have a way to preserve everything that you've built, but then also how do you recalibrate that with some sort of new normal as we begin to figure that out, and that normal meaning what is your revenue and profits going to look like, and then how do you integrate your culture and your leadership into the strategic plan on how to grow value inside of this new normal. And I think that people are going to be one of the key factors of getting your company ahead and using your people and leadership and your culture as a competitive advantage. And there's no one better to talk about this than the guest that I've got on the show today. His name is Chris Maroff, and he has built a thriving laboratory of cutting edge ideas for company culture. He started in a family business, quit the family business to go off on his own. He grew that company. He ended up buying his parents' business back from them. He then got into private equity. He owns multiple businesses, and he has over quadrupled his EBITDA by investing in his employees. So a few things that we're going to be talking about on the show today is how Chris quadrupled his EBITDA by focusing on his employees, how Chris scaled his companies using one major KPI, which is increasing his employees' median income, and then why Chris would give up millions of dollars instead of laying off 10% of his workforce. We'll be talking about how to harvest your employees' greatest gifts and nurture their inner greatness, and by abolishing the two things that can erode profits and employees' mental states. And Chris had a great definition of how do you quantify culture. He said that culture is the sum of everybody's worldviews inside your business. And he talks about how he's been able to quantify that and then actually make decisions about how to refine the collective worldview of the cultures that he's been working with, and then how to use that as a differentiator to grow your company and invest in your leaders. And Chris has got some very tangible stories and descriptions of how he's invested in his leaders to create this competitive advantage, because he describes how leaders and executive leaders are the largest leverage point and bottleneck of any business. So by investing in your leaders, you're essentially gaining leverage across all your companies and all your customers. I like this episode a lot because we cannot forget that businesses are made up of employees and people. So not only do we have to treat our employees well, but how we treat them and what you're doing right now as a business owner and leader will impact the future viability of your business. And the leaders that are able to maintain the financial health of their business while also keeping their culture and leaders intact are going to come out of this with a competitive advantage that I don't think others are going to have. There's a couple ways that we can help you as you get clarity into this subject. One is that we have built out a couple digital products in the last 6 weeks. We created one that's called Mastering Your Cash Flow video series. We have three big parts of this cash flow series. One is how to build your 13-week cash flow statement, a bunch of videos and downloadable templates on how to actually build that. The second part of it is how to build and revise your 2020-2021 budget and forecast from the ground up. So revising, making sure you've got the correct forecast and the correct target of net profit, EBITDA, and revenue as we get into this new norm. And then the third part of that is how to build a strategic plan to grow value in the long term. So think about it kind of like get clear on all your numbers, get intentional, which is building that strategic plan. And that's what we're going to be talking about with Chris in this episode, is prioritizing the right things to come out of this with intention. And then the third part is to get going, which is executing on that plan by integrating your financials and your strategies together. So that way you can be focused on value creation as this new norm comes into play. With that being said, I really hope you enjoy this episode with Chris Maroff.
sponsored by Arcona's Growth and Exit Boot Camps. 2 days jam-packed with material on the 5 growth and exit principles and the world of mergers and acquisitions. You'll walk away knowing exactly what steps to take to get your target valuation and your best exit option. 2 days at Arcona's Boot Camp will give you the clarity to control the rest of your journey as an entrepreneur.
Chris, how are you doing?
I am great, Ryan.
We are both cooped up, opposite ends of the U.S., but same situation going on as everybody's dealing with. And I'm looking forward to today's show because I think leadership is always important. In today's world, it's more important than ever, especially as people are dispersed, dealing with, you know, chaotic issues. And I just think it's important. So I think it's going to be a fun episode because I think people need it, honestly. So why don't you, for the listeners that are not familiar with you and your background, kind of just give us a little bit of a cliff note version of how you started the business and then what you're doing today and kind of the whole alignment leadership and what you guys are all about.
Absolutely. So yeah, my parents and I started a company back in 1995. And so leadership was, you know, 22 years old. It was not even a concept on my mind. It was just surviving a startup with my parents as my boss, which always makes for an interesting scenario. But that business grew pretty rapidly. Fast forward about 15 years, I was the CEO of that company as my parents were nearing retirement, and decided to move my family away from all of our friends and family from the Boston area down to Austin, Texas, to start out on my own. You know, it's always that feeling over kind of looking over your shoulder when you start in a family business. At least for me, it was feeling like I really could accomplish something on my own. And so that was the reason for the big move.
Did you quit the business when you moved?
I did.
Okay.
I did. I walked away from that. And a few years earlier, I had actually tried to start a company in Texas doing similar work that we were doing. And we work in the K-12 industry. So we work consulting with school districts. So I tried here in Texas to start that same kind of company a few years earlier with starts and stops, but decided to jump out on my own in 2011. And that's when I moved to Austin, Texas with 6 employees. Fast forward about 8 years now, and we have about 200 employees in that company. We work with about 700 school districts all over the state of Texas. And then a year and a half ago, decided to let my parents finally retire. And so I bought their business from them as well. No. So we have, yeah,
that's
so we
awesome.
We have work in New England and Texas. We're spread out across the country. And then about a year ago, decided I wanted to grow up and do my grown up job. And so pivoted from the K-12 industry into private equity, and now own and operate about 12 businesses, most of which are right here in Austin, Texas.
So many questions about this entire journey, Chris. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
So many. Okay. Let's take them in bite-sized chunks. So why, like, what was the dialogue going on with your folks that you decided to quit and move? Because I worked in a family business as well. So, you know, for you to go back and buy them, I love how, you know, there's the circle of life. And I'm just saying that because I'm watching so much Lion King with my kids being at home a lot right now. So yours was a different kind of circle. So what was going on there that led you to get out?
Well, you know, I tell the story now, and it's thankfully at with good retrospect, I've been able to process through what happened 9 years ago. But, you know, basically I'm coming into my own as a leader, as a CEO, and I just happen to be a person with a growth mentality. From an entrepreneurial perspective, my goal as an entrepreneur is to solve problems by employing people. And that kind of circles back to this concept of really having a growth mentality. My parents were nearing the end of their careers and wanting to wind down. And so that just created a lot of friction. So when you talk about dialogue, I have to admit it wasn't a lot of healthy dialogue toward the end, because, you know, they're wanting to take the company in one direction. I'm wanting to take it in a very different direction. And so it led us to the conclusion that we should probably part ways in order for us to kind of live out who we need to be at that moment.
How big was their company at that point?
We had about 60 employees.
So did they have a different, like, backup plan, you know, for you guys, or?
you know, they wanted to step back in. They were going to step back in, and they did as the CEOs, kind of a co-directorship of that company when I departed. But to make matters more complicated, I also have two brothers who also work in the business, and I'm the middle child. My oldest brother, of course, growing up, never did anything wrong, or always did the right thing, I say. And then my younger brother is the baby, so he no matter what he did, never did anything wrong. And then there was me, who did everything the hard way, it seemed like. And so when we had board meetings, there were four opinions and then nine, and they were never the same. And crazy. So I knew it was about time that I needed to either get in line with what they were wanting or kind of, march out on my own.
I mean, we know how that went.
Yeah.
Well, and it's really interesting because one of the biggest concepts, Chris, that we teach in our Intentional Growth Bootcamp is the difference between ownership and management roles. And the biggest challenge that family businesses have are partnerships where it's like, hey, we all own a forest. We're going to all get paid $100,000. Right. And we're equalize everything with ownership or with management roles instead of saying this is an asset and we need to separate the asset and this is how it's valued versus actually working roles. And if it's too many times, it just all gets coagulated together. And that's where so many complications have.
It does. It gets really messy really quickly, especially when the mentality of my parents, which I don't blame them, and they weren't wrong for thinking this way. It's just different thinking. I'm an entrepreneur. So for me, it's not about the ownership of the company. It's about the growth of the company. Whereas I think a lot of people love the idea of owning a business. In fact, I call them professional hobbyists. It's a lifestyle business. And really what it's designed to do is provide income. Whereas my brand of entrepreneurship is really about growing something in order to sell something. And so that's really ultimately how I pivoted into private equity.
So, yeah, I mean, our stories, I just love it. So we can go by the timeline. There's a couple of different ways that I think, because my curiosity will just go along a timeline. But then also we've got your main concepts of what you're doing with your alignment leadership. And, you know, so I'm just kind of curious, maybe, you know, give us some of the guts of you started your business, you grew it enough. I mean, now you got 200 employees, right? And then you bought your parents' business. So maybe we start with this, Chris. How did you start thinking about value creation? Because there's this mindset shift that I really like to tap into, where people shift out of this hobbyist or like, and I have people that I know, Chris, that have $20 million jobs, right? Where they focus on top line revenue and net profit, and they only look at their P&L, have no idea what it's worth and how to grow value. Yep. And it's just maximizing K1. And I think that those individuals and companies are probably struggling a lot these days when cash dried up like that. Yeah. Where did that happen for you and how did you do that?
Yeah, it was thankfully when I moved to Austin, I immediately got plugged in to a faith community here through a church. One of the first people I met, he owned his own business in private equity. And, you know, we had a conversation and I'm so green in owning a business and running a business. I was just in awe of this guy. I was just, really fanboying over what he was able to do. You know, this guy came out of college, worked for IBM for several years. At 29, decided to launch out, created his own company. And at 33, sold it for about $40 million. And so, you know, immediately I tried to connect myself to his way of thinking. And so really being a learner was a big part of it for me. I'm just not naturally a humble learner. I hate to say that about myself, but I tend to be an experiential learner. And so therefore, if I haven't experienced it, I have a hard time believing in something. But the way this guy really presented himself and the way that he looked at business, I looked at it as the way to look at business. And so that's when my mindset really shifted towards this building of value in something. Yeah.
So, okay. I love it because it is my way of describing that, Chris, when that happens, because I went through that unfortunately I went through that after the exit, which a lot of the people that I'm on my podcast go, oh shit, I wish I would have known that. You know what I mean? Yes. As I'm getting raked across the coals from a private equity firm that's talking about weighted average cost of capital and due diligence. But when you have that, it's almost like going from two-dimensional to three-dimensional thinking. Yeah. You know, like the conversations that a lot of entrepreneurs have, you start to realize are kind of irrelevant. And so how did you take that into putting that into practice, like how you were investing in the business and tying that to a long-term strategy. What did you do to make that actionable?
Yeah, for me, the biggest actionable item has been to remove our central leadership and create expendability amongst ourselves. And so that our intellectual property wasn't in our leadership team, but it was in the philosophy of business. And so what I had to do is I had to become irrelevant to the business. And when I did that, I started to develop a leadership philosophy around alignment leadership that allowed all of us as the executive leadership team of this K-12 business to be expendable, that we weren't necessary. And then what that did is it allowed us to really really identify and then grow leaders at an amazing rate. And that mm-hmm. is, to me, the way that I quantify growth and quantify value. So our EBITDA, you know, 4 years ago when I started this journey of really the first inklings that we were going to move into private equity, and now 4 years later, our EBITDA has more than quadrupled. So you would think it'd be the other way. You know, you think you'd have to kind of take some time to build that up. But what happened, it really accelerated the growth and leadership in everyone in the organization in a way that created an amazing platform for us to even start shopping that business today.
So amazing. And by the way, your EBITDA quadrupled. I'm assuming your multiple did something very similar.
Very similar. And the reality is if a business owner could really understand, you know, I want my, we talk about this all the time. I want my median income of every single employee. I want it to be as high as it possibly can. And because what happens is then, like you said, everything else is a factor from that number. But what a lot of businesses do, a lot of what I call lifestyle businesses, is they focus on the K-1, and what they're doing is they're forcing the K-1. Whereas I've been able to experience multiples of growth, compounding growth, by it's focusing instead.
Growth. I mean, like literally, that's yes.
That's right. And so what I do is I focus on raising the salary of all of my employees, that medium salary, as high as I can, because I know that at the end of that, my multiples will be a factor.
That's really interesting. And it's I experienced something probably on a micro scale of that, Chris, when we were turning the business or my family business around. So it was ended up being a turnaround for the first 5-6 years before we started hitting our stride. And then we sold it to a strategic competitor that took away most of it. mm-hmm. That's why I didn't want to do them. But the when you experience that leadership, it's like the theory of constraints where it just goes poof, and you're it just like it's amazing what your executive team can do with that leadership. So how are you doing that? Like, and then what is, you've kind of packaged it up, right? So like how can you do this?
Yeah. So what we did is we really started to figure, first of all, my journey has been, I grew up in New England as I call it typical New England. We're not feelings oriented as men. And so I don't have any background on this empathy game, but man, about 4 years ago, I was really challenged to figure out what was the most important thing when I walked in the door at work. And the journey I've been on is that it really has been people. And so this idea of really aligning with my people, alignment leadership, has really been to value people for who they are and not what they can do. And what's happened is it really just unleashes them to do things that previously they nor I were just aware of exactly how powerful they were. We call it kind of recognizing people's greatness. And that greatness is really seen through the application of their intrinsic value. They have value because they're human beings. It's my job to find that value. And we define that value based primarily on two things. One is soft skills. And so we spend a lot of time talking about soft skills, kindness, compassion, determination, dedication. There are hundreds of them. Find that soft skill, find those soft skills in your people. The other part of value is really about their passions. What are they interested in? And so what we do is we spend a lot of time really discovering the value of our people, and then we get to unleash it. We call that recognizing their greatness. And when we see their greatness, we see them for who they are. It has been amazing to watch people evolve into the very person that we've imagined them to be from the moment we hired them. It's been really exciting.
So it's really cool to hear you say that, because when I'm thinking about the one time that I kind of knew this because I was always in, you know, basic leadership, you know, roles throughout my growing up. And like when I was in the business and we were juggling cash flow and really hard times, kind of like we are at right now. I mean, we were juggling $250,000 payroll every 2 weeks. We'd hit it and then we go, okay, we hit it. And as we'd hired these good people that were in the trenches with us, it just, you really got to see the people. Cause it wasn't like us making so much money up at top. And you know, there was like this, you are peasants. We are, it was just kind of like, everybody's got to help fix this. Otherwise we can't keep doing it. And I was in this spot, Chris, where I looked at my CIO who we were building out the managed IT services. And he would literally, I mean, this guy was making a lot of money. He came over there because of our vision and our culture. And then he would like literally go crawl through closets with cabling. And I'm like, you're so awesome. Like he just selfless to the point where it was amazing. I sat him down. I'm like, what, as a younger person at that point, I immediately thought how to reward him was by giving him cash. Right.
Right.
He's like, Ryan, I just want some extra PTO because I love four wheel. It was like these big Jeep ATVing. And I'm just like, and it was this, is this spot, Chris, where I said it was like, just because of how well I got to know him and just respecting who he was, that it was just like, oh, I mean, to this day, he's still a great friend.
Yeah.
And how, like, is that, I mean, that's kind of what it sounds like. You're just dialing into the people. And it just,
Yeah. We're trying to abolish or get rid of two things that really ruin people's careers. They ruin their experience with career. You know, I'm at an age now where I'm in my upper 40s and I'm thinking to myself, man, I don't want to get to the end of my working days and regret the time I spent. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get rid of regret. So we reverse that and we call it fulfillment. The whole goal is that people look back over the time spent at work, away from family, away from friends, and they don't look at it as a waste of time. Love the fact that I don't feel like I have to work a day in my life. I get to go in, go to war with people that I absolutely love. And it's not even dependent on the thing that I'm doing. It's really dependent on who I'm doing it with.
Totally.
And so we really want to get rid of regret. We want our employees to feel like this is fulfilling. Man, I worked my butt off this week. I worked hard. I dug a ditch, but you know what? At the end of the week, it was the right ditch to dig. And I was in there with my friends and it was awesome. Worth the effort. So that's one thing we're trying to get rid of. The other one from a leadership perspective, which always plagues us, is loneliness and isolation. And anybody who's been in leadership understands when you have to make a final decision, decision-making alienates people. Everybody wants to criticize the decision that you're making. I hate the concept that somebody wants to question my motives. If people want to question my methodology, absolutely. It's all on the table. We'll all fight for the best idea. Yep. But I hate when people question my motivation. That's very hurtful to me. And so we want to get rid of loneliness and isolation for leaders as well. So that's really what alignment leadership is there to do. It's really to create fulfillment, but we do that through authentic community. And so our goal is to make sure we don't feel like we're wasting our time. We're going to regret that time. And we certainly don't want to feel like we're in it alone.
That's awesome. Honestly, that is awesome. And you know what's interesting? After a few hundred podcasts that I've been doing with entrepreneurs that have made insane amounts of money and selling and wishing they would have done things differently and kept a lot of the stuff that you're talking about. And I know that you've had Jay from Lost the Software in Your World. He's been on my podcast. And then Bob Buford, he hasn't been on the show, but a lot of halftime people, all from Dennis, who introduced us. And there's a lot of this purpose behind this capitalism, right? Conscious capitalism. Yep, and
that's it.
And, I've learned a lot, and I've said, Chris, that it boils down to two questions that someone should answer and ask themselves every single morning. Is one, because you know these people have the reason that behind it. Before I give you the two, is that people have made all this money and they're still upset and they're still miserable.
Yes,
and
I say answer
two questions every morning. One is, what are the most interesting problems that I can help solve? And two, who do I want to do that with?
Yeah,
because if you don't have both, then it's pointless.
Yeah, over 70% of the people right now in the US hate their job or hate who they do it with. Horrible. That is one of the saddest statistics ever.
Right.
And yet at the same time, businesses and business owners, man, we just don't listen well. We want to blame it on like millennials. We want to blame it on Gen Z. Here's the reality. We've never had turnover numbers like we have right now in the US ever. In 100 years of the industrialized age, we've never had turnover. And so instead of blaming generations, how about we as owners understand, let's solve these problems. Let's create workplace environments like you did for the CIO. People will take less money to do harder work if you can make it fulfilling and you can eliminate loneliness while they're doing it.
Isn't it interesting, Chris? Like when you get it, you just get it. And when you don't, you just don't. And this is going to tie, I'm going to loop this into your PE world right now, because I'm heavily involved in this, all this world that you're talking about too. And I, for the last 3-4 years, as I've been really involved in this space of M&A and this podcast, I kind of just go, because I have your philosophy too. Yet then there's like, when you understand this world, it's amazing how much money you could make without having a soul. And I've just kind of just been like, what in the heck, man? Like, just because you understand debt and equity and WACC and all this stuff, that you can just go in there. And I've watched these PE firms go up there and just, because they're spreadsheet junkies, know how to do this and realize now that like it's different, right? Because all the leverage that they've been using, and the whole thing relies on people. I'm just like, I don't understand. Like at the end of the day, when now we have a lot of hard problems, how many people are, how are your numbers going to be when you realize that all the people that you might have churned and burned are going to be the ones that are going to have to be there for you?
It's crazy. And, you know, like I said, 100 years ago, back in the day when you're doing manufacturing or agriculture, yes, it makes sense to be an expert in manufacturing and agriculture, and people were plug and play. That makes sense. 100 years later, no, it is all about people. And nobody, you know, information and knowledge, it's a commodity now. Anybody can look up anything. What's going to get you ahead are people. In fact, being in private equity now, I love watching companies who even make crazy cash as we're looking at them. And yet I look at how they are holding back their people. They still have their people leashed. And I think, you know what? These multiples that they're talking about, I'm gonna create a tenfold on what they're doing, because what we've seen in our company is, yes, we have about 200 employees now, but the growth of our business, so we went from 6 to 200, but the trajectory of those 6, if we didn't learn this lesson, we'd be at close to 600 employees. But what we did is we figured out how to unleash our people in a way that kept the numbers down. And now you want to talk about crazy cash. What we're doing is we're leveraging our people in ways that they've never been leveraged before. Jack Welch had a story that he told years and years ago where he had to shut down, as a CEO of GE, he had to go shut down an HVAC company. I believe it was in Minnesota, but he had to go shut one down. And he goes out there to let the 60 employees know he was sorry, but the work was drying up. And there was an older gentleman in the back who raised his hand at the end of Jack's speech. And he said, "Jack, you know what? It's been sad." He says, "For 40 years, you've had my hands, but you've never had my head. I've never engaged in this work. You've never unleashed me in a way that would make this company be successful and profitable." And I think most companies, unfortunately, are run that way.
It is crazy. And you know what? I was listening to How I Built This, and the owner or the creator of Shopify, and I think he's German or whatever it was, just listening to this guy who's literally worth a fortune. And he's so matter of fact. And Chris, he says, "I didn't really want to work for the big man because they told me how to dress." And I'm like, if you don't think I'm grown up enough to figure out how to dress, then, and I just love it, because it's like, it's so true. Like, who says you can't tell adults? Like first of all, you're missing some serious fundamentals if you haven't taught them how to do that and be respectful of who's in front of you. But you're going back to the PE space, and I want to tie this. Before I forget, I want to make sure that I want to go back and figure out how you bought your parents' business, but then also your philosophy for private equity. I think there's a new space for this. And do you know Sonny Vanderbeck from Satori Capital, or Brent Bishore from Now Permanent Equity?
I don't know the latter.
He very similar philosophy, brought in the same age, conscious capitalism, you know, being able to leverage the private equity models, but then also be able to do it with soul and for the people.
Yes.
And, I'm watching these private equity firms right now, Chris, who have just gobbled up companies. Mm-hmm. And like, I know that a couple in mine right now where they can't buy paperclips. They've got so much debt, you know, they got thousands of employees and there's just no way that this works out when you have 30% dip in revenue And you're right. Just like, how in God's name is this going to work out? And they took the money from someone else. And just can you just give me your thoughts? Because on the PE space in general, based on what I just said, because there's good people like yourself, but then there's the general bell curve, and then there's the outliers. So what are your kind of thoughts right now?
So, you know, this is it sounds so stupid. I hate even saying it, but it goes back to when I was 20 years old and selling used cars. Same slogan that was true then, 26 years later, is true now: cash is king. And the reality is, debt mortgages the future, and it really limits your ability to get creative. You know, when this whole coronavirus thing happened, of course it impacts us. It impacts all of our organizations, like everyone. But man, I'm so thankful I learned lessons younger around the flexibility that that cash gives you. So, you know, with all of this happening, yeah, I'm so thankful that we've had no layoffs, we've had no furloughs, we've been able to keep everyone and the organizations going. And that is due to the fact that we've put ourselves in a cash position to do that. You know, we'll lose in one of our ventures alone, we're going to lose about $3 million of revenue this year. And that's a big hit, obviously, to the organization. But we've been able to come up with a system by which we can pivot to not only make some of that back up, but then also to survive. And that's really what this is about. I would rather take a $3 million hit than have to lose 10% of my workforce, because that 10% will make that $3 million back within 12 months. So it's the short-sightedness to think, well, I'm just going to lay people off and maybe I'll be able to hire them back. To me, it's doubling down on your people in a way that will give you the best chance at making your money back. And so, yeah, that's our goal right now, is we're trying to do everything we can to keep everyone employed in a way that will let us bounce back faster than anybody else.
Well, and I wanted to pull that thread too, because I can only imagine when I think about like the hard times that I've navigated, and if you've got the ability to withstand the blow financially, then protecting your employees, how many creative ideas are going to come out of your employees that are not scared, right? They're not trying to, like, you know, I mean, I think about just the pure openness and the camaraderie compared to someone that's going to lie to keep their job. I literally actually, just a small story, and then I want to hear your thoughts, is I got off the phone with this doctor for my sinus infection. Of course, I got a sinus infection when everybody else got COVID, right? And I'm like, no, literally, it's just a sinus infection. She was telling me that there was an employer that is comping people an extra dollar amount to stay at work and put people in harm's way because of their balance sheet. And it's just like, and you know, everybody knows it, right? We're all adults, so everybody knows that's wrong. And it just shows, versus like taking someone like yourself and saying, okay, everybody, let's figure out how to pivot. And knowing that people are safe. Is there any examples that you have of, like, you know, kind of the magic that happens there?
Yeah, we had a great example recently where, so one of the ventures I own, it's a hospitality company, and the hospitality company, we operate restaurants. So obviously we've taken a big, punch to the gut here. But what we did is, one of the things that got me into this is I bought a catering business about a year and a half ago. And, you know, the creativity that we've had with the catering business is that's what pivoted us into the restaurant business. Well, guess what? We're back to the catering mentality where we can still do delivery and we can still do pickup service. And so we have a commercial kitchen in downtown Austin, and we pivoted into this concept of, it's basically ghost pizza is the mentality. It's so pizza delivery with no brick and mortar. And so we pivoted big time. Well, that's literally kept every employee of that hospitality company employed.
Oh, cool.
And so to make matters worse, one of the guys that we had running down in that kitchen got sick, had a cold. But, you know, like everything at the time, you couldn't really test to make sure it wasn't the coronavirus. So we told him to stay home. His roommate also worked in the hospitality company and actually ran delivery for us. And so we said, well, listen, you know, we don't know what your roommate has, and we don't want to treat you, you know, I know you're roommates, but you also work together and you work in our kitchen, and we've got to be really careful with our clients. So we want you to stay home as well. But we're going to go ahead and pay both of you for the next 2 weeks to make sure that you're safe, that our clients are safe, that our employees are safe in the kitchen. And I got an email from him the other day, and he was just saying, I can't believe you let me do this. You let me stay home. You're still paying me. And he came up with a list of about eight ideas that he was willing, he couldn't wait to get back there to jump in and to go for it for me and for his coworkers. So I'm telling you, if you can unleash these people in a way, it will change the way business is done, but you got to believe in them first.
That's awesome. I get the goosebumps here and that, because times like now have to have good leadership like that. Because I mean, people deserve it. Like you said, I mean, honestly, like for waking up and having to go through work every day, like you said, and enjoying this, and people the human nature is someone wants to feel like that, right? Like who wouldn't want to come up with eight ideas for their employer because you're part of it together. I mean, versus sitting at home crabby and in spite, can't wait to get better. Can't wait till the coronavirus disappears so I can quit and go somewhere else.
Exactly.
like, I mean, they're going to do everything just to keep employed, which means there are no ideas, none of this stuff. So you're still paying them and they're doing the least amount of work possible and everybody's upset. I mean, the productivity that's not harvested because of it is ridiculous.
Yeah. And we don't have the luxury here. We're in Austin. We are in such a deep competition for talent in general anyway, you know, Google and Apple and others. And so, you know, it's constant for us to figure out how we're going to keep our competitive advantage across all of our industry, all of our ventures. And it's always back to people. And so they are worth whatever expense, but that's what I keep going back to. We can afford to do it. Thank goodness we can afford to do it. And we count ourselves very blessed to be able to do that. But it goes back to that philosophy that every company should have, which is that cash is king. If you want to go out and do, you know, crazy, amazing things with your business, build up your own cash reserve, you know, borrowing money, it just unfortunately, in these scenarios, it makes it really difficult to honor your people the way they deserve to be honored.
So, a couple of things on how to create that kind of culture, right? I mean, like, because it's one thing to like, I'm just thinking about, like, I've never systematized it because I mean, I haven't had the family business for a handful of years now. And like, it was a lot of me. I was like the culture guy, and we didn't have any, like, you know, prescription values and stuff like that, which I think we could have gone one step further and probably created that. But like, so two questions. One is, how do you create it? And the other one is, I'm curious on the financial incentives. And the reason I'm asking this, Chris, is, are you familiar with Jack Stack, The Great Game of Business? He's been on my podcast, and my partner did an ESOP. So there's a lot of, I'm very familiar. I like private equity and ESOPs, and there's a bunch of stuff here where, like, how do you create the culture and systematize it?
Sure.
With or without ownership, right? Because I think the financial incentives have to come there. Because you can have a great culture, but sitting there staring at the people up top who make cash is king, or making, you know, rolling, you know, Scrooge McDuck, you know, how do you align that, all that stuff together?
Yeah, it's a great question. The reality for me is, like, the systemizing of it was more out of just my own frustration. So I'm a big reader, and I loved reading these books around culture, leadership, and so on, but nobody ever takes the time to really gives you the tangibles about how do you create a culture? Like, what is this thing? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants a good one, right? Everybody says, well, I hope my culture is good. I want my culture to be a good one. But I never read a book that really helped me understand how to create one, or how to recognize what I had and then how to shift it or cultivate it. So what we did is I came up with this mentality. Well, a culture is really the collection of your people's worldviews. You know, when we walk into a room and we have a conversation, there are potential conflict points around every corner. You know, whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat, whatever conversation is coming up, there's a reality that there's a potential point of conflict. And it's always because you have different worldviews. And the worldviews are a set of traits that we have that make up that worldview. So, for instance, like my hopes, my preferences, my traditions, my experiences and my beliefs, those traits make up my worldview. It informs every conversation I'm in. So when I show up to a conversation, my experience with this, my traditions, what have been my preferences, what are my hopes, most importantly, beliefs. Beliefs are the most powerful worldview trait that we own. In fact, it's the one I always say that always leads to war. And so the conflict that comes with a belief system that we have, that really is the definition of our culture. So anytime you have more than one person in a room, you have a culture. It's not about creating one. You have one. You just need to define it. What is that culture? And we define it as the sum of everyone's worldviews. Then what we do to cultivate it is we say, okay, it's not good enough to understand what the culture is here. We now need, we want to cultivate it toward the kind of culture, toward a culture that we want. And since I'm the owner, what I want for the culture of my businesses matters more because I have to be willing to pay for or fund the organization. And so what we do is we create a purpose for each of the organizations. And purpose is so much better of a term to me than mission statement.
Oh my gosh, yeah. To have integrity and
Who doesn't? So a purpose statement, I say, always has to have a give before the get. There has to be, I'm from Austin here, and so we refer to the Alamo quite a bit. But you know, in the Alamo, the leader, the night before they got invaded, he drew a line in the sand, and that's where that phrase actually comes from, a line in the sand. And he said, if you want to save Texas, step over the line, but what it'll cost you is your life. So we create purposes that have a give and have a get. And they're not just, hey, let's feed the world or let's save Texas. You have to identify what they'll be giving up in order to get that. And so our purpose statement or a purpose that we live under has to give us real good description of the destination of where we're going. And so the cultivation of the culture now, we leverage that purpose to tell us what to do every day. So if you know your destination really well, then you should know what to do tomorrow to get there. And so that's what we really identify that as prioritizing our most precious commodity on this earth, which is time. Most people don't prioritize their time. And that's because they don't have a clear destination. They don't have a clear purpose for their organization that informs everyone in the organization what to do. And my good friend, I wish he was my good friend, what his words are is what's the next thing you do. And that's from Gary Keller's book, The One Thing. So that is the most important thing to do, is the next thing.
So can you give me an example of a purpose statement for a company that one of your companies?
Yeah. So one of our companies, again, is a K-12, and we work with special education. Specifically, we work to get them back dollars from the federal government to help pay for services to students with disabilities. So what we came up with is we want to maximize educational documentation so that we can help discover and develop students. So the give is that we have to collect this documentation. Why? Because we all want to discover and develop students. See, the purpose could have been, we want to really help discover and develop students, but you haven't identified what the hardship will be, what is the hard work that's involved, and that is we have to go get this documentation. And that's hard. Anybody who's worked in the educational realm understands it's really, really difficult to get data into your hands in order to make the best decisions for kiddos.
Yeah.
So that's the call to action.
So how about the financial piece of this? Because I think that's amazing. Because between the beliefs, the purpose statement, I absolutely get it and I love it. And so how then do you tie financials into this? I mean, obviously you're rewarding them with high salaries and stuff like that. Is there other ways besides, because you're in private equity, it's not an ESOP, right? So there's no ownership or anything like that. So is there ways to financially tie this together with people as well?
There are, but I think that goes to the kind of one of the concepts we talk about is that we really want to find out what does motivate your people.
Right.
For some, it is money. Others, it isn't. Yep. And so what we do is we sit down and we figure out with them, what does success look like? If success, because for some people, they'll give up short-term money for long-term ownership. So we look at it in multiple different avenues. Some really want responsibility. Some want the financially being tied in with the business. Some want higher pay. What we do is we really discover with them what they're looking for. How do they define success going forward? Yeah, and then we create a path for them to get there.
I totally agree with that. So then when you think about one of the challenges that I've seen, Chris, that a lot of stories have come from on my podcast of people that have been upset afterwards is this, the business becomes their identity. So all this stuff that you're talking about, I mean, I just watching you, obviously we're in video here for the listeners, is you know, the business becomes a derivative of you, all the decisions. I mean, like, like a lot of these things, this is an ecosystem of Chris, right? I mean, like, and who you are. What happens is I see that people go to sell the business and it's the big dollar amount, right? And so this comes, like, if you're probably the people that are selling to you, one of the things in our intentional growth bootcamp is really understanding their personal drivers. So that's the principle number one, and aligning that and being able to have a decision make mechanism to say, okay, here's how much it would be to sell to Chris versus XYZ private equity firm that's going to load it with debt, not care about my employees, et cetera. But I'm generalizing there, but I think the challenge is for a lot of these sellers to say, okay, what is important to you and your business and how to align that with someone else? Because they probably haven't, a lot of people haven't become aware of this stuff that they're talking about. So how do you, you know, when you're sitting across from the seller, how do you get them to talk about that stuff instead of just the dollar amount?
Yeah. And everything that we've done to date has been, I don't know how to say it. You know, the conversations we've had with owners, I'm thankful in one sense that they're not really thinking along those lines. Most of the folks that we've had conversations with are family businesses that grew beyond their capabilities. And so what happens in those scenarios, because it's been a lifestyle business for so long, they're not even contemplating those kinds of concepts. So what we've really focused on is when we talk about valuation, we talk about coming up with a bid or a number that makes sense to them. We really find out from them what their exit strategy is, like what really motivates them. And then we create for them, in at least in our opinion, a picture of what that could look like. If somebody were to come and talk to me about one of my businesses, I know that one of the things that we've talked about with our managing partners is, okay, what are the non-negotiables that we would say? Well, a lot of that has to do with the people involved. And so, yeah, we want factors of EBITDA, all those things. Absolutely. We're not, we want to maximize those dollars. But what has informed that is conversation with key executives within the business to say to them, what do you want? Do you want a 3-year contract with the buyer? Do you want a consulting arrangement with them? Do you want to follow us? So we've sold a business. We've lived out our 12-month obligation of that CEO. And then I turned around and hired them 12 months later to help me run another business. We've done all of those things in a way that hopefully lines up and kind of speaks to the imagination of our people. I just have yet to find a business that we've been in the process of negotiating with who have also had that same mentality. It's very singular focused on the amount of cash they can take out of that business.
Yep. It's so true, isn't it? And then it takes that shift of mindset to understand like how all this works. So I'm curious, how did you do that with your parents? Probably
I will say it was the same process in that, you know, I just said, well, what do you guys want? And then what I did is I worked backwards from there with the numbers to make sure that I wouldn't be stupid for doing it. You know, I want the world for them and they deserve it. You know, these guys gave, you know, my mom especially, and she worked in public education for her entire career until we started our business together. And, you know, she would still consider herself a recovering principal, a high school principal. And so I wanted the world for them. And I was willing to pay more as long as it made sense in what we could do for that business and kind of flipping that. And so the questions were the same, like, guys, what do you want? What do you want out of this? Most people on this planet don't talk about the things they should actually talk about. Most people talk around the things that they need to be explicit on. And so anybody who's negotiated with me, anybody who is listening to this, who has negotiated with me will know, I like to just talk about the elephant in the room more than anything else. It's my favorite conversation point because it's what gets business done faster and more effectively is when we just talk about it. So anybody, I've had companies call me or private equity firms call me about some of my ventures, and you know, they're wanting to dance around things. I'm like, here's the deal, guys. I'm not going to waste your time. Here's what I'm looking for. And now you get to figure out, like, is this something that you want to do? But yeah, shoot straight and, you know, put your cards on the table as it relates to what exactly do you want, either as the buyer or the seller.
Do your brothers still work for you?
They do not. So the company kind of split. I bought a portion of it. So it was all over New England. And so I bought the New Hampshire-based business. My brothers kept operating and still operate the business that's based in the state of Maine.
That's awesome. So when you're, you know, given the time that we're in right now, and I think that, you know, I don't know, maybe you could have two parts to this question. One is that what is your overall opinion on the economic toll that this is going to take? Because I think this is going to be, I think it's going to be really hard for the next 18 months because of the ripple effect that people aren't even talking about. I love macroeconomics and monetary policy, and it just, I'm an internal optimist too. And I can't be here, Chris.
Right.
And so that's,
it's a tough scenario.
Maybe first part of the question. Second part is for the leaders that are going to be dealing with this, what is your suggestion? So first, what do you think is going on? Like,
well, it's kind of a perfect storm in a negative way. Not only is this going on, but we're in an election cycle and with a lot on the line on that election cycle. And so if anybody knows from a private equity perspective, what happened when some of the policies that came into be, you know, during the Obama administration, a lot of folks in private equity withdrew their money. And so you had trillions of dollars sitting on the sideline. If that were to happen again, at the same time that we go into this economic crisis in the next, then I think it will have a compounding impact in a bad way on the economy. So to make a bad situation, a terrible situation, even worse. And so, you know, it remains to be seen on that. I'm certainly not for one side or the other. I hope that whoever's in office in January will make it appealing for private equity to keep their money in the game, because that's really what will help this economy bounce back, or our jobs. And so no matter what happens, that's what I'm hoping for. I'm an optimist as well. And I think that if the money stays in the market, it might only take us 12 to 24 months. If the money gets pulled, I'm fearful it might take quite a bit longer than that for the economy to be able to bounce back. So that's it's unfortunate, but that's kind of where I am. And I tend to be more of an optimist, but this is a toughie to feel optimistic about.
Even, and that's kind of on the kind of the plumbing of the financial system too that you just referred to. But the challenge too is the sheer amount of small businesses and the people that were living payroll to payroll as a small business owner. I just
terrible.
Yeah, man.
It's we got to put the money to work. That's my number one thing. Put the money to work. If you're an entrepreneur, you know, if you can get your hands on money, when we're done with this thing, and hopefully in a few months here, this is what I'm telling everyone, put your money to work. When you put money to work, you're putting people to work, and people are our only way out of this. They're going to reinvent this economy, but we got to get them to work.
So then if you're an entrepreneur listening to this, what are your suggestions from your philosophy on the fulfillment and passion and the purpose, and what would be your takeaways?
So again, this goes back to a little bit of my entrepreneurship kind of philosophy. It's fourfold. Number one, solve a problem by employing people. That's number one. Number two, have a huge risk tolerance with money, and have a very low risk tolerance for time. And this goes back to how we can jumpstart the economy is if you employ people, put them to work, even if it means that you have to sacrifice your lifestyle for right now, it will pay off in the long run. So the third kind of philosophy as it relates is going back to the age old, you gotta be a hustler, you gotta get creative, and you're gonna have to put in some sweat equity to figure your way out of this thing. That's another major component. And that leads me to the final one, which is you've got to stick with your growth mentality. You've got to be a grower, both of people and of money.
Grit, right? That's what's going to take it. I mean,
it's going to take grit, an amazing faith, amount of grit.
For grit and faith, man. It's right.
The rewards will be there for those that do.
Yep. I agree with that. Well, for the listeners that really resonated with your messaging and stuff like that, where can they find you, your book, your website, all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. So website, I would go ahead and have them go to alignleadthrive.com or they can go to chrismaroff.com. Either one will get you some good information on entrepreneurship, most importantly on leadership, how to show up for people, how to love and serve them toward fulfillment.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. Very timely, and it was exactly what I wanted. So hopefully the listeners enjoyed it too.
Thanks for having me on, Ryan.
I hope you enjoyed that episode, and I have a couple big takeaways for you. One is that if you do not realize that your employees are as valuable as Chris had talked about, I truly believe what he says, that you can quadruple your EBITDA, have a competitive advantage like no one else if you do this right. The key is to make sure that you can afford to do this right. So I suggest that if you do not have absolute clarity on your numbers and a strategic plan that ties to value growth and how you can afford to invest in your people like Chris talked about, check out our Mastering Your Cash Flow video series. It's on our website, arcona.io. We got a landing page that goes there. We got a couple big sections about how to get handle on your 13-week cash flow statement, how to revise your annual budget and forecast, and then how to build value growth with the long term. So once you have clarity on your numbers, you can specifically identify where you're going to invest in your people so that way you can still afford it and you're not sacrificing potential bankruptcy or potential erosion of profits because you're doing it the wrong way. It's built into your plan and it's tied to employee growth, value growth, and the ability to have more options and freedom down the road. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and I look forward to seeing you next week.